It's time to pour a cup of tea and fall down a rabbit hole with us. You're listening to Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast with Jackie and Elsie.
Hey, Jackie.
Hey, Elsie. What's
this
up?
This is Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast. Nothing much is up. I just interrupted you.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to try not to clear my throat a million times. I've got, like, perpetual allergies here, and it's terrible. There was something I wanted to talk about, and now I can't even remember what it was. I guess I'll just dive right in, and then maybe I'll think of it later. Did you need anything? Did you have anything to talk about?
I was just going to ask if you had heard about the case that's going on in Indiana right now with the missing baby. I think her name's Amira.
No. I hadn't heard anything about it.
I don't know, like, all the details or anything like that, because it's kind of like a newish thing going on, but, like, this little baby has gone missing, and I don't know if they've found the body yet. I don't know if it's that far into it, but it's, like, been on the news and stuff, so I didn't know if you'd heard about it. I just heard about it the other day.
Like,
my dad asked me.
Abduction?
They acted like the parents might be suspects at this point, but I'm not, I mean, like I'm said, I'm not really sure, like,
yeah,
I don't really have any of the facts. My dad brought it up. Yeah. I think her name is Amira, but I can't remember. But she's apparently missing, and I don't know if she's dead or if they don't know for sure yet, but I would look it up, because I just found out about it the other day. My dad said something about it, but
yeah,
I figured maybe you had heard. But that was all I was going to ask you.
I have a couple of disclaimers before I start. First of all, I had started out doing a completely different story, and I almost finished it, and I was like, this shit is boring, and I don't want to talk about it. So I completely went a different direction. And this weekend is like my Mother's Day / birthday trip with one of my best friends. And we are going to a haunted hotel in Arkansas. And I was going to do that one. And then I thought, well, I don't want to look all this shit up right before I go. Because she's not even into this stuff. So if I freak myself out, then I'm going to look like a big dork. Because she's not, like, she's totally not into this stuff. So I'm doing the most haunted hotel in Arkansas, and arguably one of the most haunted hotels in America. And that is the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. And so for my very important date, the Crescent Hotel was actually built in 1866, and I looked it up, and it was like Boar's Fest. So I went with another significant date. That was a little bit more fun. So I cheated a little bit. But I'm doing 1937. In 1937, the average cost of a new house was $4,100. Average wages per year was $1,780.
God.
Cost of a gallon of gas was 10 cents. Average cost for a house for rent was $26 per month. A loaf of bread was 9 cents, a pound of hamburger meat was 12 cents, and the average price for a new car was $760. And I did, I don't know why I don't learn that I can't use the down button on this stupid laptop. Okay, so notable things that happened this year. Amelia Earhart mysteriously disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. I thought that was interesting. After multiple searches, Amelia Earhart was declared legally dead on January 5th, 1939. Walt Disney premiered Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was the first Technicolor full-length animated movie ever.
God, I knew it was old, but that's like old, old.
Super old. Like, you wouldn't think they had the technology old.
Literally, yeah, I'm almost a little shocked.
And I wonder how much it cost to go to the movies then. I didn't find that, but that would have been interesting.
Oh, good question.
This is a good one. At 7:21 p.m. on May 6th, while attempting to dock with its mooring mast at the Lakehurst Naval Air Station, the Hindenburg bursts into flames. It killed
the humanity.
35 passengers. We shouldn't be laughing at that, but that's funny.
No, I'm sorry, but...
crew and one ground crew. It's like, turn off your mic, dude. Like, you don't have to do a play-by-play, but I guess we're still the same way. We have to know everything.
True.
British author J.R.R. Tolkien released The Hobbit, which was published on September 21st. And San Francisco's iconic Golden Gate Bridge officially opened in May. The first total solar eclipse to exceed 7 minutes of totality in over 800 years was visible. And the president of the United States was Franklin D. Roosevelt. So those weren't
You're
like...
left when you read or when I read my stuff.
Is it similar?
Yeah.
Okay, I worried about that when you said your year that I was like, crap. But, oh well. It's still interesting. People will have forgotten by your story anyway. I don't even know if anybody's interested like we are, but I think it's cool.
I like that stuff too.
Okay, so the Crescent Hotel. The 1866 Crescent Hotel and Spa was built in 1866. let's see how many times I can say 1866 in this episode. Located in the hills of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is gorgeous. The hotel was built by the Eureka Springs Improvement Company and the Frisco Railroad. It was a 78-room hotel, and it was built for $294,000 on 27 acres into the West Mountain, and it overlooks this beautiful valley. And like I said, it's widely known to be one of, if not the most haunted hotel. A little bit about Eureka Springs. So, Daryl and I actually went here for our honeymoon, and we will probably never go back because it's really expensive because it's a touristy town, and he had to spend like $8 on a hot dog, and I've never heard the end of it, and we were like super poor back then. But we actually did like, we did a ghost tour at a different hotel, and then we walked around the Crescent. So I've actually been there. And funny story, there's the Christ of the Ozarks, which is like a giant statue of Jesus with his arms out, like the one in Brazil, kind of. And he has a video of me running toward it with my arms open. Like, I'm going to hug it. And my mom said I'm going to hell for that. But that's just a funny tidbit. So the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas has like a ton of natural springs. And in the mid to late 1800s, like, people would travel from far and wide to experience the healing powers of the water to cure whatever ails them. Like, they thought this water was magical. So the developers of the hotel kind of saw this hotel as welcoming the masses to the most luxurious resort in the country. That's what this was supposed to be. The hotel was built with 18-inch walls, which I write this down like I even know how thick walls normally are.
Like what a standard wall is.
Yeah, like it sounds thick.
I have no idea. It does sound thick.
It has towers, balconies. It has this massive stone fireplace in the lobby. The dining room once sat 500 people. The grounds included a swimming pool, tennis, and croquet courts, opulent gardens and gazebos, stables of 100 horses, and they had tea dances every afternoon and parties every evening. It opened its doors on May 20th. Tea dances, like they would get together and have like fancy tea and then they would dance after. Like it was like probably an excuse to get drunk in the afternoon, I would assume. So after 2 years of construction, it opens this grand ball. It's attended by 400 celebrities. So, however, during the turn of the century, people kind of caught on that these waters weren't like as special as they made them out to be, and they were no longer clamoring to bathe in them. So they stopped coming, and the massive hotel, it was just unable to keep itself afloat. So in 1908, it was turned into the Crescent College and Conservatory for Young Women during the school year, and then in the summer it continued to operate as a resort. But by 1924, the college and the resort weren't enough to cover the costs of running it, and the hotel sat abandoned until 1930, when it was reopened as a junior college in 1934. So, I chose 1937 because this is the darkest period of the Crescent Hotel. In 1937, Norman Baker bought the hotel, and Norman Baker was a piece of shit. He claimed he was a doctor who could cure cancer. He was not a doctor. He was a quack, and he was born in Iowa, and he was run out of Iowa, basically, because he was charged with practicing medicine without a license. And so that's when he decides to move down to Arkansas and buy the Crescent. He called it the Castle in the Air, and he reopened the hotel as the Baker Hospital. He began bringing in $500,000 a year, which in today's money is nearly $9 million. He claimed he could cure cancer with injections of corn silk, watermelon seeds, clover, water, and carbolic acid. And this with the quote-unquote healing waters of the Ozarks, you know, he's like convincing these people, this is the health resort you need to come to. So people start flocking to Arkansas as a last-ditch effort to overcome their cancer. Like, he's preying on, you know, the most vulnerable people. And let me tell you, as somebody whose family has been touched by cancer, like, you will do anything. Like, you will try anything. Yep. So while no one actually died as a direct result, they did die from not receiving proper medical care in time. When we took the haunted tour, they told us, like, because when you take the Basin Park Hotel, which that's the other hotel in Eureka Springs, they tell you about the Crescent too. And they told us that they would never remove the dead from the rooms during the day. They would be left there until the hospital was quiet, and then they rolled them out on gurneys under the cloak of night. So, like, these dead bodies would sit in their rooms all day long.
My God.
All in all, it was said that he swindled $4 million from desperate patients, and in today's money, that is nearly $70 million. In 1939, he was finally convicted to serve 4 years for fraud, and once he was released, he moved to Florida, where he lived comfortably until his death in 1958. So nothing even came of it. The Crescent, on the other hand, sat vacant from 1940 to 1946, and this was during wartime. I think we both have wartime stories. In 1946, it was purchased by four Chicago businessmen, and they began to restore it, but they never really restored it back to its full glory. They kind of restored bits and pieces, but it did once again. It began to thrive, and then this fire in 1967, like, blazes through the south wing and, like, destroys most of the hotel. So over the next couple of decades, really, the hotel ownership would change hands several times, and nobody was ever really fully able to restore it. And in 1997, Marty and Elise, I'm going to butcher this name, I think it's Roenick, they purchased the hotel. And so they stated in, quote unquote, in 5 years, we pledge to have this grand lady of the Ozarks back to where she was 100 years ago. So all these people in Eureka Springs are like, they don't believe them because they've seen this a million times. Like, everybody says they're going to restore it, but they do. They begin by rebuilding the spas, and they opened the 6,500 square foot New Moon Spa, which included hydrotherapy, massage, tanning, showers, and exercise equipment. And then they restored the skyline, and it's just beautiful. Like, you'll have to look it up. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous hotel. That's where I wanted to get married. But when we were engaged, like, we got engaged in May, and then we were going to get married, like, the November after, because that would have been, like, I want to say it was, like, my parents' 30th or 30th wedding anniversary. Yeah. So I wanted to get married in November, and I wanted to get married at the Crescent, and then Daryl called me. He was like, hey, let's get married in 3 weeks. So we didn't get married. So they restored the skyline. It was over $1 million, and it included a 3,500 square foot penthouse, the original observation tower, and the 200-pound, 2-foot-tall Crescent Moon weather vane. And that's kind of like the iconic thing about the Crescent, like this gigantic Crescent Moon on top. Actually, I don't even think it's on top. I think it's in the yard, like on the grounds, but I'm not sure.
Oh, like a sculpture?
Yeah, like it's like a... It may be on the top. I don't remember. Probably should have looked that up. So after spending, I never know when I'm going to go off on a tangent and think things that I didn't think when I was actually writing a story.
That same thing happens to me.
After spending $5 million, the Crescent had been restored and it reopened on September 6, 2002. So we're going to get to the good stuff. This is the hauntings. Now I'm going to tell you my sister's haunting story. And that has another disclaimer. Because I swear my sister and my brother-in-law told me this story. And so I texted him about it. I was like, hey, remember when you told me the story? And neither one of them remembers. And I'm like, I'm going to kill you both. Like, I know you told me the story. And my mom remembers the story. Anyway. But she had told me that one of her friends, they were taking a shower. And then when he got out of the shower, like, you know how the mirror fogs up. In the condensation of the mirror, the word boo was written across it.
Ew.
And I swear to God, she told me that story. how would I have made that up? But anyways, let's get to some documented stuff. One of the resident ghosts is a red-headed Irishman who was a stonemason during the original building. And allegedly, while he was working on the roof, he fell from the roof to the second floor. And it's like 5 or 6 stories. I'm not sure. But he died instantly. The area that he fell in now houses room 218, which is said to be the most haunted room of the hotel. Michael likes to tease and play tricks on people. He's said to turn off and on the lights. He opens doors and he turns on the TV, as well as pounding on the walls. Others have seen ghostly hands coming out of the bathroom mirror. And some have reported hearing the sound of what is described as a screaming man falling. And then, like, in the ceiling, they hear a thud. Some have reported being shaken awake in the night, and one person reported seeing blood all over the walls. This guest ran out screaming.
I would think.
Of course, like, there's many apparitions reported from the Norman Baker era, including Dr. Baker himself. He has been seen in the basement, the stairway, and in the bar, and he's always dressed in his signature color of purple. A nurse dressed in all white is seen, and like it, and that's like one of his main things. Like every time you read about him, like his signature color was purple. He wore purple all the time.
That's weird.
A nurse dressed in all white is seen pushing a gurney on the third floor, only spotted after 11 when the bodies would have been taken out. She vanishes at the end of the hallway. People who don't see the nurse sometimes report hearing sounds of a gurney. And the area used as a morgue still has an old autopsy table and a walk-in freezer. Hotel maintenance has reported the washer and dryer turning on by themselves in the middle of the night. They used to have this antique switchboard that they used, but it continuously received calls from the empty basement, and they discontinued use of the switchboard. In room 419, there's a woman who introduces herself as Theodora, a cancer patient. She's often seen by housekeepers, and then she quickly vanishes after introducing herself. In the lobby, there's a man that is, like, dressed in full Victorian garb. And the thing is like, they do reenactments here a lot, too. So, like, people will go up to these people and talk to them. But this guy, they see him by the stairway, and it says that he sits quietly, and he never responds to conversation, and then he just disappears. And these aren't, like, one person saw this, one person saw this, like multiple people have said these things happened to them.
Right.
In the Crystal Dining Room, dancers in Victorian dress are often seen in the early hours of the morning. Some have reported a man sitting near the windows, and if you approach him, he will say, "I saw the most beautiful woman here last night, and I'm waiting for her to return." A former waitress claims to have seen a Victorian bride and groom in the massive mirror. The groom made eye contact with her, and then the pair disappeared. The spirits in the dining room are said to be very playful. There was one Christmas, and, like, they do everything up, so, like, Christmas is a big deal. Everything's a big deal. One Christmas, yeah. The tree and all the presents were moved to the other side of the room, and all the chairs were in a circle around the tree. One morning, the staff arrived to find all the menus, like, strewn about the dining room, but everything else was in place. In the kitchen, there's been a little boy that has been seen skipping, and pots and pans are known to fly off their hooks. A young woman who once attended, and this one is the one that's like, you can't document this. This is like a, you know, a legend.
Yeah.
A young woman who once attended the Crescent College and Conservatory of Young Women supposedly either jumped off or was pushed off a balcony, and guests report hearing her scream as she falls. Rooms 202 Yikes. And 424 are also said to be a bevy of activity. And this one cracks me up. I don't know why. A ghostly waiter carrying a tray of butter is seen in the hallway.
Well, because anyway. Why would you just have butter?
Well, first of all, like, how do you know it's butter? Like, is it just like a big tray of, like, butter chunks?
A big old and, like, can tub you imagine of, like, country coffee. Like,
and can you imagine if you had to spend your entire afterlife just carrying a tray of butter down the hallway? Awful. So, Ghost Hunters, the TV show, they actually visited, and I've seen this, and you can look it up on YouTube, but they captured a figure of a man in the basement on thermal imaging cameras. And, like, I used to watch Ghost Hunters, like, all the time. And they never really found anything that crazy. This was fucking crazy. Let me tell, like, it was fucking crazy. Like, you could see a man. It was.
I don't like it, that.
It's creepy. So if you want to visit the Crescent, and by the way, like, these, it's restored to 1866 glory. So the rooms are kind of small, but it is a beautiful hotel. But the rooms start at $119, which is pretty awesome. You can stay in the governor's suite for $229 or a cottage for $269. And the thing about the Crescent is, like, the hotel I'm visiting this weekend, they will not talk about paranormal activity. Like, this hotel, like, Al Capone used to stay in this hotel, and he has his own suite there, and they've boarded up the Al Capone suite because it's supposedly so haunted, but they won't talk about it. Like, you can't just ask an employee, but the Crescent, like, really embraces their hauntedness. They have all kinds of events and tours. It's like, it's super fun. And Eureka Springs is beautiful. If anybody has the opportunity to go there, I would definitely suggest it. I will never go with my husband, but I would go back. There's another local hotel, which is the Basin Park, and it's also said to be haunted. That's the one we took the tour of, and it creeped me out real bad because it's like 1940s still, but it's like 1940s, like, business class, and, like, everything's like green shag carpeting. Like, it's creepy as hell. But you can buy packages for both tours.
Is that the one where you were with Daryl and then you, like, left because it was, like, such super bad vibes?
Oh, no. That was the tuberculosis sanatorium in, in Boonville, which they don't let you go up there. Like, they'll let some paranormal, like, official paranormal groups go up there, but if you get caught up there, you get in a lot of trouble. So I probably shouldn't have even said where it was. But, no, that was the time I went ghost hunting, like, all night and was miserable. But the Basin Park, like, they just take you around, and it's really neat. We had this one woman in our tour that was like, I feel a presence, and it was really annoying, so, but it was fun.
Well, can you feel it away from us?
Like, and she was wearing, like, a t-shirt, like, one of those t-shirts, like, that has, like, howling wolves on it. You know what I'm talking about? Like, that kind of person. And she was very dramatic. I wonder if Daryl even remembers that. But anyways, I suggest you go. It's a lot of fun. But that is the story of the Crescent Hotel in my home state of Arkansas.
I like it.
Okay, so real quick, we're going to pause for a brief message. And this time it's from Jackie, because I'm sure people are getting tired of hearing my head. So we will be right back.
Okay, we're back. Hopefully you didn't think my ad was too annoying.
No, I'm getting sick and tired of hearing my voice. Trust me.
Okay, so mine's kind of long, so sorry about that. But it's a good one. I mean, not to toot my own horn, but, you know, toot toot. For my very important date, My year is 1944, and so just FYI, pretty much every single fact was about World War II, and that was, like, just, like, mildly depressing for me, so I just kind of glossed and only chose a few. So, FDR, who you also talked about.
Well, I mean, he was president for like 27 years.
I know. Well, he was the only president to serve 4 terms, so I put that in. Sunscreen was invented.
Oh, that's cool. Have you ever seen Juno when she's like, he's like talking about something and she's talking about the president she thinks is hot? She's like, Roosevelt. But yeah. Franklin, not Teddy, the hot one in the wheelchair. Like, that always cracks me.
Yes. Well, because Teddy has those, like, weird monocle but not monocle glasses, if you know what I'm talking about. Like, they the arms that go behind his ears. Like, they just sit right on his nose, and they're super awkward.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know why I know that, but... So,
I didn't realize sunscreen. That sunscreen was... Like, I don't know when I thought it was invented, but I don't know.
I guess I wasn't sure either. Like, that's why it kind of intrigued me. But they invented it, actually, for the troops in the war.
Oh, that makes sense.
And it was Coppertone brand was the first sunscreen.
I can't tell, though, if I feel like it should be before then or after then. Like, it's just a weird thing I've never thought of.
I felt like after then, but I wasn't sure why I felt that way. I mean, I guess I had zero idea. So
that's really cool.
I did a bunch of prices too. So gas was 15 cents.
Ooh, it went
bread
up.
Was 1 cent cheaper at 10 cents. And a brand new house was $3,450. And so those were my picks. Yeah.
That's crazy.
I just kept it brief with those because, like I said, like, every single one of them was, like, on this day in the war, and I was like, okay, but the war was kind of sad.
I guess that with the war time, that times were a little tighter, so things would have definitely gone down.
Yeah, true story. Sorry, I had to take a drink.
Okay,
so I'm just going to start. In the mid-20th century, circuses were kind of a big deal, and they traveled from town to town by trains, and they performed in big, huge tents known as big tops, and the biggest circus of the time was the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. So, their big top could seat 9,000 people, and I guess I didn't really know that, like, because I don't know what I thought circuses were like. I've never really been to a circus, just to be honest. I fucking hate clowns. I don't really like that they use wild
animals.
See,
and I'm like oddly
kind of
obsessed
a fucking hippie.
With circus. I mean, I don't like the animal part prospect, but I'm like kind of obsessed with like just the weirdness of old circuses. But I didn't realize that they would seat that many people. But I guess, I mean, what the hell else are they going to do? You could probably like, get in for like a nickel and spend all day there right. or something.
Well, and then I was thinking about it, and I was like, well, no shit, it would have had to have been huge, because they were fitting, like, fucking elephants in there, and then I don't know why that didn't occur to me, but I just was like, wow, 9,000 people. But because of the war, there was, like, a lot of shortage of staff and equipment, just because everything in America right at that moment was, like, being tied up in the war effort. So because of that, there were a lot of delays and issues, and they were becoming really common, even though it was usually like a really tightly run circus, like they were on their shit. So like August 4th, 1942, there was a fire in a menagerie and it killed several of the animals. And then in Hartford, Connecticut, in July 5th, 1944, a train delay caused a show cancellation. There were two shows that day, but it canceled one. And in in circus superstition, it's like extremely bad luck to miss a show. And the show ran okay that night, but the performers and the staff were like super nervous about it. So the next day, July 6th, there was an afternoon show, and it was a really large crowd, but since it was on a Thursday, it was mainly, like, women and children in the audience, and the crowd was estimated to be at around 7,000 people. So, the Lion Act was first, so they did that, and it was great, and they were followed by the Great Walindas, which was, like, a really big acrobat act at the time, and shortly into their act, the band leader, Merle Evans, spotted a small fire, and so he had the band strike up the Stars and Stripes Forever, which is a tune that they used to signal distress to, like, the other circus folk to get them, like, into action. So he was playing that, and he played that until the fire caused a pole to fall across the stage, forcing him to stop. So the ringmaster, Fred Branda, attempted to calm down the crowd and tell them not to panic, but the power had failed and he couldn't be heard. So people are freaking out and they're kind of stampeding toward the exits, but the animal cages, like the lions, when they came in and out of the big top, they had like these, kind of like chutes that they would walk through. So they couldn't like just roam off into the crowd or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was like total chaos. People are running around trying to find their loved ones. People were splitting open the tent to try and escape. And then some people just sat in their seats and stayed put, just assuming that the fire would be put out, like, pretty promptly. But the thing you have to understand is, I mean, it's 1944, so, like, they had coated the outside of the tent with 1,800 pounds of paraffin wax, dissolve in 6,000 gallons of gasoline, because at the time, that was the common method of waterproofing.
Holy shit, I know they were all smoking in there.
Yeah, and so it caused the flames to spread, like, I mean, just instantly. Like, it was really fast. So the melting paraffin wax dripping down from the roof was landing on people and burning them. And the tent collapsed in about 8 minutes, trapping tons of spectators underneath. And in the midst of all this, a reporter snapped a really, like, now it's a famous picture of a sad, okay, and this is not my wording. I stole this directly from Wikipedia, so everybody hold your torches and pitchforks. He snapped a picture of a sad tramp clown holding a water bucket, and it was called, like, that picture, they called it, like, the day the clowns cried, and, like, you can find the picture now. Like, it is kind of a bummer of a picture. So, many people burned to death, but others died as a result of the general chaos, because some died leaping from the tops of the bleachers, like, thinking that if they could jump down, they could get out faster, but instead, you know, died doing that. And then a lot of people got trampled to death, which led to them dying of asphyxiation. And, like, it was such chaos that they said that there were bodies piled three people deep, from, like, people surging out and trampling over others. Although they did find some people alive at the bottom of those piles. There's, like, some discrepancies in the death tolls, but most people agree that it was around 168 people that died that day, and that's just based on a collection of body parts labeled victims. Many think it was a lot higher than that, for a lot of reasons. So, like, one, there were poorly kept residency records in the small rural towns back then. And then, for two, some smaller remains were never identified or claimed. And three, it's now believed that the intense heat from the fire mixed with the paraffin and gasoline could have incinerated people completely because of how hot it would have burned. God.
Can you imagine the smell and having to rescue
just
people?
Awful.
God, awful.
So terrible. So
I'm also pretty sure this isn't like an isolated event. Like, I'm pretty sure circuses caught on fire a lot, didn't they?
Did you notice that? I don't know if it's a lot, but I know that there were definitely more than one. So they also had handed out a bunch of free tickets that day in town,
And many of the people that they gave the free tickets to, according to the employees, appeared to be like drifters who might not necessarily have had anybody to claim them or, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
So, in addition to the deaths, there were over 700 people who were treated for injuries, and they believe that number is probably also higher because a lot of people were seen heading out of town back home in shock without seeking medical attention. So they think that they probably just wandered out in a daze and then had to be treated later.
Mm-hmm.
68 of the estimated 168 deaths were kids aged 15 years old or younger.
Oh.
And they don't know the cause for sure. A lot of people think it could have been like a flicked cigarette that just hit the wrong spot and burned. And then there's also a question, like, could it have been arson? It's not really known. So to get to the investigation, charges of involuntary manslaughter were filed, and the circus reached an agreement with Hartford officials and just accepted full financial responsibility. You know, they totally owned it, and they paid $5 million to the victims and families, but they said they would not accept responsibility for the fire itself because they couldn't, you know, prove what had happened, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Five men were charged and brought to trial, and four of them were convicted given prison terms, but shortly after that, they were, like, pardoned entirely. And one of the men who were convicted was James A. Haley, who later served the U.S. House of Representatives for 24 years.
Huh.
So, in 1950, Robert Dale, and I think it said CG, I'm not sure, or Seagy, from none other than the famous Circleville, Ohio.
Oh, I love Circleville.
He confessed to police that he had set the fire. And during that time, he also confessed to setting a series of other fires and several murders since his youth. So he says that he worked for the show when he was about 16, from June 30th to July 14th, and he claimed that he had a nightmare where a Native American riding a flaming horse told him to set the fires. He then stated that his mind went blank, and by the time it was clear, the fire had been set. On November of 1950, he was convicted in Ohio of, like, unrelated arson charges and sentenced to 44 years in prison. And the investigators in Hartford didn't really believe him because, like, he was known to have a history of mental illness, and there was no proof that he'd even been anywhere near Connecticut when the fire happened. And yeah. Also, the Connecticut officials weren't even allowed to, like, question him. So they were just like, yeah, okay, basically. Yeah. And then later in his life, he even denied setting the fire at all. And he died in 1997, I think it was. But, like, no one really thinks that he did it. So if it were arson, the true arsonist has never been found. Like, this guy claimed it, but nobody really believes him. They think he probably just said that for attention and because he was a little bit cuckoo. Okay, so after the fire, they kind of set up, like, a makeshift morgue, and they laid bodies on cots for families to try to identify the bodies, and they gave them, like, numbers. So there was one little girl in a blonde dress, or in a blonde dress. She was her dress was made entirely out of hair. No, she was wearing a white dress and she was blonde, but she had died of asphyxiation and she was extremely well preserved. Like you can see a picture of her. And she only has a few burns on, like, the left side of her face and then a little bit on her forehead and nose. But other than that, like, you can clearly see her facial structure. I mean, it would have been very easy to identify this little girl. But no one came to claim her, even though she was, like, in basically perfect condition. So the Hartford police, Sergeant Thomas Barber and Sergeant Edward Lowe, were obsessed with identifying this little girl. And
well, yeah, she had to come from somewhere.
Right, exactly. And Barber, he was like a widower, and the day of that circus, his two children were supposed to attend, but they hadn't arrived when the fire broke out, so they were safe. So I think that's kind of like part of why he was so hell-bent on trying to find out who she was, because he kind of felt like a little bit drawn to it, you know what I mean?
It was personal.
Yeah. So they were, like, desperate to find out who she was. They took dental impressions. They took footprints, fingerprints. They photographed her. They showed her picture to everyone who claimed a body the night of the fire. They visited orphanages. They wrote to schools and sent her picture, and just nothing turned up. Nobody claimed her. And so, like, Barber brought flowers to her grave on Memorial Day, Christmas Day, and July 6th, which was, like, the anniversary of the fire. Like, he never failed to bring flowers to her grave on those 3 dates. Like, he was just, like, super attached to this little girl. And when he died in 1977, a local florist, like, carried on that tradition, which I found really sweet. But by, like, 1981, like, nobody had, like, they say nobody had found out who she was. But the other cop, Edward Lowe, his widow came forward and said that he had identified the little girl and contacted her family, but that they didn't want publicity, so it never, like, came to light. But in 1987, a random note appeared on her grave, and it said, Sarah Graham is her name, 7/6/38, date of birth, 6 years, and then it said twin. And they found notes on nearby graves saying that her twin brother and, like, other relatives were buried nearby, but that was neither, you know, confirmed or denied. And in 1991...
Why would you claim her? I just don't get it.
See, and nobody has any, like, definitives whether his widow just said that, you know, and I don't know if that's true or not. Like, that's just one piece of information that I read. Like, because if they never came forward, then it's like, how are we supposed to know, you know what I mean, that that's true?
Right.
Like, maybe she was making it up so that people would feel less,
like, closure or something.
Yes, like, that's what I think. So in 1991, an investigator named Rick Davey wrote a book called A Matter of Degree, The Hartford Circus Fire and the Mystery of Little Miss 1565, which was the number that was given to that little girl. And he claims in his book that her name is Eleanor Emily Cook. And he'd spent 6 years researching the case and, like, conducting his own experiments, attempting to figure out how the fire started. And, like, he didn't work on the original case or anything like that, but he was just, like, obsessed with it. And he called the original investigation flawed and primitive. And he believed that the guy, what was his name? Sorry. Robert Dale Seege was actually the arsonist. Like, he believed that story, which nobody else believed. And in 1955, Eleanor's brother, Donald Cook, contacted authorities claiming that this little girl was his sister, but nothing came of it, and I don't really know why. But he later worked with Rick Davey, the guy who wrote this book, and they tried to establish, you know, her identity. Her brother thought that it was a mix-up at the morgue and that they were shown the wrong body. But that can't be confirmed either. But nobody who worked on the case originally bought this story, like, that this was Eleanor Emily Cook.
Well, and especially, even if it wasn't, like, it was a, if that was the case, there would be records of a missing little girl.
Right.
Like, you know what
because
I'm
it's like, not like they would just stop trying to find her or something, you know
right.
what I mean? So, like, nobody bought this story, and another writer named Stuart Onan, he wrote a book called The Circus Fire, A True Story of American Tragedy. Like, he brought up
Hold on just a second.
Molly.
Car dog. Daryl just knocked on the window to scare me and set the dog off. Calm down, it's your daddy. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
It's okay.
So irresponsible.
So this guy, Stuart Onan, brought up some, like, points, like saying there's no way that it could have been Eleanor Emily Cook because this little girl, Little Miss 1565, was blonde, and Eleanor Cook was a brunette. So there's strike one. You know, I mean, you don't just change hair colors. Their faces look nothing alike. They were different heights, and their ages didn't match up, which I'm not sure how they knew Little Miss 1565's age. Like, I guess they were probably just guessing, but, like, unless the other one was significantly older, how would you really know? You know what I mean?
Right.
But that's what it said. So Eleanor's mother, Mildred Corintha Parsons Cook, vehemently denied that that Little Miss 1565 was her daughter. And she maintained that until her death in 1997. Like, she just said that was not her daughter. And she had been badly injured in that fire and hadn't been able to claim her two dead children that day. Like, she was just super burnt. And then by the time that she was able to, like, get back and do it, they said she was just too emotionally traumatized to, like, go back and claim them and blah, blah, blah. She believes that Eleanor was one of the two children. There were two children who were burnt beyond recognition, and she thinks that Eleanor was one of those kids. And as a further point, Eleanor's dental records didn't match Little Miss 1565's. So I don't know why, but even without proof, Little Miss 1565 was exhumed and buried next to the body of Edward Cook, Eleanor's other brother and another fire victim. And in 1992, her death certificate was changed to Eleanor Emily Cook. But the Cook family, like, still doesn't believe it's her, except for her brother, Donald Cook. So it's just kind of like a weird deal. Like, it's just one of those mysteries that they don't know for sure who she was. And I just find it so odd that they would go ahead and change her death certificate and everything without proof.
Well, and I find it odd that the mother would be so traumatized she wouldn't claim her child. Like, I can't imagine any situation.
That's what I thought too.
I would do that, but I don't know.
Yeah, it was very, it's just a super odd situation. And I found that, like, there's books and stuff written about just specifically this little girl and, like, kind of the mystery that surrounds everything with her. But let's see. Sorry, I lost my place. In 2002, the town started the Hartford Circus Fire Memorial Foundation, and they erected a memorial at the fire site. And the Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus visited Hartford during their final tour, doing their final Hartford show on April 30th, 2017. And that is the story of the Hartford, Connecticut Circus Fire.
Well, when you first started and you said arson, I thought, like, I didn't believe that because, like, everything caught on fucking fire then. There were, like, no fire codes. People smoked everywhere. But then now with this little girl, I'm like, I've got, like, 1,000 conspiracy theories in my head. Like, what if they sent her off to the circus and then started the fire? And
it's just so weird because, like, you should look her up. Like, you can see a picture of her body, but, like, it's not, like, creepy.
Yeah, it's not gruesome. Yeah,
No, I thought it was not. She just has a few. Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell because her hair kind of blends in with, like, everything else, you know, kind of like the
black and white picture. Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, she doesn't look all that damaged. Like, you as a mother or a father, you would be able to walk up and be like, yeah, that's my child. Like, it's not like
she
was burned beyond recognition.
Well cared for. Like, she doesn't look like, you know,
a dirty hobo kid
child. Yeah, like, she looks like a well cared for child that somebody would know, you know, would be missing.
Right. And she's wearing, like, that pretty little white dress and, like, you know, like,
now
you said,
I
she's
look
not
at
like
missing
dirty
persons cases from the 1940s in Hartford.
It's just so weird because, like, who is this freaking little girl? And, like, no, none of the schools recognize her. None of the orphanages recognize her. Nobody claimed her. Like, where did she come from?
Somebody needs to get some DNA and do one of those family things.
My other thought was, like, Golden State Killer. Seriously. Like, what if both of her parents were burned in the fire? You know what I mean? Like,
burying her under that name when it's, like, clearly not that kid. Like, it's so weird. Yeah.
Creepy. And, like, they, yeah. I read something that was, like, you know, they could probably dig her up now and do DNA tests and stuff, like, as far as, like, you know, with how far that kind of stuff has come, or at least, like, compare it with what we have now. But they don't want to do that and, like, cause more, like, drama, I guess, you know, because it's already been this whole big thing. And I'm just like, but why did you go ahead and do that? Like, you should have just left her unidentified. Like, her, like, the mother of that other little girl obviously did not think that was her daughter. So, in my opinion, it's almost, like, borderline disrespectful for them to have done that. It's just so weird. But it was a good one. I had never heard about it. This was a Reddit find.
I don't want to say, you know what I mean, but, like, disasters like that really interest me. And I was going to do was actually a disaster. It was a hotel collapse. But
I love disasters.
There were just so few facts and stuff that I was just like, this is kind of like me. But it's a good story, but like for our podcast, I didn't think it was bizarre enough, I guess.
Yeah.
That was a really good one, though.
Thank you.
I pulled up the article on Amaya if you want me to read a little bit of it, because I got some.
Please, because I haven't had chance yet.
It says, okay, so she's been missing. And it says that, she disappeared on March 16th. And the family reported her missing. It says, investigators say Amaya was last seen alive with 20-year-old Robert Lyons at 1:15 p.m. on March 9th. Robert told Amaya's mother, Amber Robertson, which if she was last seen with him on March 9th and they didn't report it until. Anyway, it says Robert told Amaya's mother, Amber Robertson, that Amaya was with the babysitter, according to police. The babysitter reportedly denies that Amaya was with her. Lyons is considered a suspect. I wouldn't read his name, but he is considered a suspect in Amaya's disappearance, but detectives are not actively seeking him. Detectives are urging anyone with information on Lyons' movements between March 9th and March 16th, while he was driving a 1996 maroon Isuzu Rodeo in poor condition, to call Crime Stoppers.
If you saw that
hell?
Well, I knew that they were like
out an alert days after she was reported missing and searched the babysitter's home on South. This all sounds weird. They found some of Amaya and her family's belongings along a bank at Eagle Creek. And that's all it says.
I knew it was a weird one because my dad, like, he is not into true crime. And so for him to bring it up to me, like, I knew it had to be something kind of different, but he didn't have all the details, of course. But he says, I mean, of course, I should probably save this
story to me. I forgot. What'd you say?
My dad thinks the parents are guilty. Sorry.
No. Well, it seems like it's very strange.
Yeah. So I'm kind of waiting to see how that all turns out.
I don't want to. I shouldn't say this, but it kind of reeks of a Casey Anthony situation, like when she said the babysitter.
Well, and also not reporting it, you know, like, until, what did you say, like, a couple days later?
Yeah. Like, I want to say,
what the fuck are you doing?
On March 15th, and she was last seen with him on March 9th.
Like, if I haven't seen my kid in 10 minutes, I'm kind of freaking out.
Yeah.
I mean, probably exactly. Less than that, to be honest.
I don't know. It's super weird. We'll have to keep up with that one.
Yes.
All right. Well, good job.
Thanks. Anything else?
I don't think so. I think that's all I got.
Me too.
I swear there was something I was going to bring up, and I can't remember what it was. But if it was important, I'll say it next time. But anyways, thanks for listening.
Go like us on Facebook.
Yeah, and please like, rate, and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. And email us at siximpossiblethingspod@gmail.com. Thanks.
Please do.
Bye.
Bye.
Thingspod@gmail.com. Thanks. Bye.